Our next case this morning is United States against Frost.
May it please the court. My name is Josh Moss. I'll be speaking on behalf of the defendants in this case. Because our time is short today, I'd like to focus the court's attention on the loss to the government issue that's raised in the party's briefs. We're going to ask that this court, with respect to that issue, remand for a resentencing based on zero loss to the government. When dealing with a conspiracy to commit a fraud case, as we have here, the sentencing court has to examine under sentencing guidelines 2F1.1, has to look at what is the loss to the victim. And in a case like this one where the defendant provided services, the court has to decide whether this is one where those services benefited the defendant.
Counsel, I must say I'm not sure why the value of the services is pertinent to the loss. And coming at this for the first time, my inclination was to think that the critical question pertinent to the loss is whether the loans would have been guaranteed had the Frost provided the documentation that this was a Chicago branch, the documentation that the United States believed should have been provided. The loans would have been guaranteed anyway, then it's hard to see any loss. If the loans would not have been guaranteed, then there seems to be real loss.
Well, I think that you've hit on a couple of prime points in this case.
But whatever point I'm hitting on was not a point raised in your brief.
Well, it seems that if I understand your question, Judge, it seems that the government has made the argument that the loan should never have been made, and therefore there's a real
loss. I don't know whether the loan should have been made. The argument that was persuasive and that led to a criminal conviction for your clients was the proposition that certain documents that should have been required to enable the guarantor to make an intelligent decision were not provided. Now, it may be that even had those documents been provided, the loans still would have been guaranteed.
And that was the
government's in the same financial position. But it doesn't seem to me that either at trial or in the briefs on appeal are the parties joining issue on the question whether the same guarantees would have been provided had all the documentation been given to the guaranteeing agency?
Well, in fact, I think that at trial that was one of the defenses of the defendants, and that was to try and prove, and we think that we did prove, that in fact the loans would have been guaranteed had all the appropriate information been given.
Maybe you did get into this a little bit, but there, of course, you run into the awkward fact that the Indiana agency was never told that it was being asked to guarantee loans for Illinois residents in the contiguous county, Cook County, for an Illinois institution, and that when it later on was told that that was what it was being asked to do, it said no, it wasn't going to. So isn't that some evidence to suggest that the answer to Judge Easterbrook's question is that wouldn't have happened?
Well, in fact, actually, if you look at the record, the letter from the Indiana agency rejecting, I think it's in 1993, rejecting the secondary application, doesn't mention as a reason for the rejection anything having to do with the prior conduct of asking it to have, and unwittingly, evidently, guaranteed loans for children or students from Chicago.
No, they talk about the dropout rate.
They talk about the dropout rate, and they talk about the school's performance several months after the school had been placed on reimbursement by the Department of Education and was admittedly struggling at that time.
But doesn't that at least bottom line tell you that the only shred of evidence we have on this is that for whatever reason the Indiana agency wouldn't have done it?
I don't think it answers the question as to whether in the first instance had that application been made when the school was still healthy and still on a regular funding schedule, whether that would the school would have been approved. The school was approved by the Department of Education. It was licensed by the state of Illinois, and it was accredited by ACID, the American Council of Accrediting Associations.
The statute gave that Indiana body the authority to grant that, did it not?
The statute, which
about contiguous counties?
Right, the contiguous county rule allowed the students that were attending MCI Chicago to get loans for attending schools in Chicago. And while the administrator that testified for the government attempted to say that they didn't intend the statute to say what it says, he had to admit on cross-examination that, in fact, the statute said what it said and that students from a contiguous county were entitled to get loans. So,
well, I would rephrase that a bit. The fact that it's a contiguous county puts it in a group where it's possible to guarantee, but surely the Indiana agency has other eligibility criteria as well. I mean, sometimes it probably guarantees loans for Indiana institutions, and sometimes it may think they don't qualify, too.
Well, I think that what you're pointing to on the question is, you know, did the defendants violate the law by not asking ahead of time
that they could guarantee? They certainly presented a misleading picture to the Indiana agency.
And the defense and the argument in the briefs on that point is, well, they thought they had the right to do it as they did.
But why did they think that? Why would the statement of some Illinois entity in any way make you think that a completely different entity was just going to agree with that?
Well, the Illinois letter is fairly clear. It says
you say, we're not going to do it. Go ask the other state.
Well, it not only says that, it says go continue to do business with the with that.
Go ask Indiana. It doesn't say go defraud Indiana.
Well, I think the letter says continue to do business with SASE. So the question of their good faith or not, we believe that given that, and you have to remember, these are not lawyers. These are people who operate a business, and they see a letter that says continue to do business.
Right. It's actually only a lawyer who would think that a letter like that said go defraud Indiana.
No, I don't think that.
No normal person would think that.
Well, I think that a reasonable reading of that letter says, and it says your address and code for the Indiana Hammond address is the appropriate one. So, and I think to get back to the loss issue here, the question of whether SASE would have or would not have granted the guarantees doesn't really answer the question of the loan issue or of the loss issue, because essentially in any time you have a fraudulent procurement.
Suppose Donald Trump applies for food stamps representing that he is poverty stricken and can't afford milk and bread, and the government gives him food stamps.
Right.
And he goes out and uses the food stamps and actually buys milk and bread. And we now come to determine the amount of the loss. Would the government's loss in giving food stamps to Donald Trump be reduced by the value of the milk and bread?
Well, but Donald Trump is not in the same position as the student.
No,
just answer the hypothetical.
I think that the answer to your question is no, it would not.
No. So the value of the benefits bought with wrongly got governmental grants is not subtracted from the government's laws. Now, why is it any different here?
Because the difference here in this case is that Donald Trump, in that circumstance, is not one of the people who are intended to be benefited by the federal government's Title IV programs, whereas the students, in this case, with a few exceptions under the ATB test case, are those students precisely qualified.
You are arguing for the principle that benefits actually provided to somebody who shouldn't have got government benefits is deducted from the amount out of which the government was wheedled.
Well,
now, that principle, if true, applies to Donald Trump as well as to this case.
I disagree with
the premise. The premise of this is that the students who got these guarantees were not entitled to them, because otherwise there would be no underlying, there'd either be no underlying offense, or you would be making the argument that I started out with, which is to say, had the truth been told, these people would have gotten the benefits anyway. If they would have gotten the benefits anyway, if the government would have issued the guarantee anyway, then it's very hard to see loss. But if we assume that the government would not have issued these guarantees on the ground that these are not people entitled to these benefits, then it's awfully hard to see why education provided to them matters.
I would concede to you if you could establish that these were students that were not entitled to these benefits, then your argument would have validity. But in the fact of this case,
and if they were entitled to these benefits, then again, the value of the educational services doesn't matter because the government's not out of pocket.
And that's the essence of our argument. That
no,
in
it's
fact,
not.
That
it's a completely different argument from the one made in your brief.
I'm not sure that I'm understanding the court's position, because as I see it, the students, the record shows that the overwhelming majority, 500 and some of the 525 students, were qualified and were...
But you're looking through to the students. They could be the most deserving people in the world, but if, for example, they were trying to go to an unaccredited school, they aren't entitled. You know, in other words, it's not just the students. The students go to a particular school, and it's the combination of what the school does and the students that create the entitlement. Here, the school didn't tell the guaranteeing agency one fact which that agency was entitled to know. Namely, we now not only operate out of Hammond, but we have a Chicago branch. Will you, Indiana agency, guarantee these loans? The Indiana agency might have wanted to look at things like dropout rates. It might have wanted to look at things like accreditation. It was deprived of that opportunity by the failure of these people to tell them what was going on. And so I think we don't look straight down to the students. Were these impecunious people? Maybe they were. I mean, I'll assume they were. But that's not the only thing.
Well, Judge Wood, aren't you, if I understand you correctly, aren't you and Judge Easterbrook both pointing to the fact is what we have here, at least what the government's position is that we have a fraudulently obtained government contract. And in all of these circumstances, the question is not whether the government agency would have entered into the relationship had it known, because clearly it would not have, because that's the essence of
and here the government winds up paying out all this money from the guarantees, since everybody winds up defaulting, practically, and you're trying to say that total loss, or actually, if the district court did it, you know, a portion of the total loss isn't the measure that's appropriate for 2F, and I don't see that. As a matter of fact, I have to say that it seemed to me on this record that although the government has not cross-appealed, you should be glad about that, because maybe the government really did lose the $2.8 million and not just the $1.9 or the $1.8, depending on which of the two cases you're looking at.
Well, Your Honor, I think that your position is similar to the government's position.
I mean, I'm just offering it for you to comment on.
My comment on the position is that it's a fraudulently obtained contract type case. This court's precedent requires that the benefit to the victim be addressed. The district court made a finding.
But you agree that the milk and the bread wasn't a benefit to the victim. So why is something as fuzzy as education a benefit to the government here?
Well, because I think that the record is absolutely clear that with the exception of perhaps 19 students, every one of these students were students that are entitled to Title IV funds, that the funds are set out for precisely this type of student. The government's position is that they shouldn't have gotten them because of something the school did, and that it was the school who should have gone through some other steps. But there's no question that these students were entitled to receive funds, that if they had attended a different school, they would have received those funds, that didn't have problems with its licensing or with its loans. And thirdly, that they received an education when they were there. So the government seeks to educate or provide funding for education. The students got an education, and there was a value conferred there, and that was a factual finding of the district court. I see I'm running into my rebuttal time. So.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mr. Moss. Ms. Collery.
Good morning. May it please the Court, I'm Liza Collery from the Department of Justice. I was going to begin with the sufficiency of the evidence issues, but since loss calculation was the primary focus...
I would actually like you to begin with the sufficiency of the evidence, because I have some difficulty seeing how the counts based on the ATB test can be sustained unless there was evidence in the record showing that the two defendants, the Frosts, knew that tests had not been administered to particular students. Is there any such evidence in the record?
The only evidence of that is circumstantial evidence that an inference could be made that they knew that this was happening. The evidence from which we believe it can be inferred is that Mr. Frost and Ms. Bracken exercised substantial control over this company. It was a small company, and the two of them were at the top and essentially ran the company. Ms. Bracken was the head of financial aid, and the admission of the ATB tests were a critical requirement in order for students to be eligible for financial aid, and therefore it would have been...
I understand that, but it's agreed that they hired Wunderlich to perform these tests, and apparently Wunderlich hired Beoshik,
right,
however her name is pronounced, to administer the tests. And it seems to be agreed that she was a scatterbrain and did not document her behavior very well and perhaps may not have performed very well. But to the extent the government is seeking criminal liability because some subordinate is not very good at what she does, seems quite difficult to sustain.
What was established with regard to her was that she did not transmit all of the test results up to
right,
the testing agent.
Right. So how do we know with respect to these four substantive counts that these are counts in which the defendants said, forget the test, as opposed to four students in which this person didn't have her act in gear and didn't transmit the records or didn't do her job right or something like that?
She was not responsible for making the decision on behalf of the company whether financial aid would be sought for these students. In fact, she wasn't even an employee of the company. Her role was simply to administer the test and to transmit the test results to the school. So then the test results go to the school, and the school needs to decide, have they passed an independently administered test? If so, then we can apply for financial aid. And so the question is, were the people who were the head of the school aware that the test scores that were necessary to apply for financial aid had not been received when the financial aid applications were made? Fraudulent financial aid applications. The evidence that we have that Frost and Bracken, who are at the head of the school, were aware that the test scores didn't exist, was their pervasive control over the school, Bracken's responsibility for matters relating to financial aid, and their simultaneous involvement in numerous acts of fraud
with
their
employees.
How does
that make them aware that the test scores didn't exist? Is there any evidence, for example, that they told Wunderlich or Beoshik directly, oh, it's good enough for us if you test 50% of the students and lie about the others?
No. There's no evidence that they said that.
Then how is it that they were aware that these scores didn't exist? Apparently you concede that they hired Wunderlich and said, test everybody.
Yes. They hired Wunderlich and said, test everybody. The evidence was sufficient to let the jury conclude that these particular students were not tested or didn't pass the test or that the test wasn't independently administered.
Let me ask you this in a slightly different way. To what extent is the government forced to rely on the fact that at some regulatory level the school was responsible for having decent records to show in each student's file that there was either a high school diploma or a GED or the ATB test?
Well, that
because
goes.
We know that the test results don't make it into the file. We don't know whether there was a test, whether there wasn't a test. Do you need to have, you know, that extra piece in this puzzle before you can prevail?
Well, that piece is in the puzzle because as we noted in our brief, the guidebooks that are put out by the Department of Education specifically require the school to retain these tests. Defendants.
Guidebooks? Any regulation require retention?
I think the regulation does as well, and we also cite that. But let me let me make the point that below, the defendants never argued that they weren't required to keep these. This is not at issue in the trial. The defendants never made the claim, well, we didn't have to keep them, so maybe we threw them away. It just wasn't disputed. They didn't argue that in their closing argument. They never argued it at any point below.
But they were arguing that they had no idea that the test hadn't been done, that they had delegated this, and as far as they knew, it was all done, and on they went.
That argument was at best hinted at below. The primary argument that the defendants made below was that there was a regulation in effect, and that the regulation conflicted with what the law actually was, and that therefore maybe they were confused and didn't even know about the testing requirement.
This effective date argument?
Yes. Well, yes.
That they got the Dear Colleague letter?
Right.
Yeah.
That's the defense below. That's what they focused on below. The question of whether the test scores needed to be retained in the records just wasn't joined in the district court. And had it been, had the defendant stood up and said, we don't need to keep these, we would have cited to the guidebook, which shows that they did, and we would have, you know, introduced the regulation and argued about it. But it just wasn't part of the case below.
But what this case in part presents on this point is, number one, who bears the final burden of the consequences of Beoshik's carelessness or whatever her problem was, and secondly, is criminal liability on the part of the people who run the school one of the consequences of that, if indeed this woman was being sloppy and maybe not testing some people, maybe not transmitting some results? We don't know. I mean, there's just this big uncertainty here in the record about counts, whatever they are, 14, 15, 16, and 17.
With respect to her carelessness, she was an independent administrator. She was not responsible within the school for making sure that the test had been taken, making sure that it had been passed, and for certifying to the Department of Education or to the financial aid people that the test had been passed. All she did was give the test. So I don't think her sloppiness in transmitting the test results on to the person that she was responsible for is any kind of explanation for why the school doesn't have the test results within their file, because the school was independently responsible.
So is it your argument that even if these students actually did take the test, that if Frost and Bracken didn't know that the test was there, that they've defrauded the government by...
No, not at all. Our argument is, first, that the students either didn't take it or didn't pass it or that it wasn't independently administered, and that the jury was entitled to infer from other evidence in the record that Frost and Bracken were aware that that happened and that they wanted that to happen because it resulted in additional funds for the school.
Where is that inference drawn?
The inference is drawn from their positions within the company, from Bracken's responsibility for financial aid, and this was critical to financial aid, from their simultaneous behavior in other areas relating to financial aid, fraudulent behavior, and directing employees to engage in fraudulent conduct, such as throwing out tax returns, encouraging prospective students to make up false information. Aunt Bracken directed students in the financial aid directed employees of the financial aid office to take names out of phone books and put them down on applications for financial aid as references. And they also had employees in the financial aid office falsely sign the names of students to loan documents. So there was a number of circumstances that suggested that they were engaging in a wide variety of fraudulent practices.
But in this case, it was the absence of any record of test results in the records they kept as well.
The absence of the test results, we believe, demonstrates that the tests were never given. And then the critical question
what
is, were they aware of that?
What people who took the ATB test failed it?
I don't know the answer to that question.
Was it a positive number?
Yes, people failed the test. Yes.
I certainly got the sense in reading this brief that the ATB test was not particularly difficult to pass.
I think people failed it. I don't know with what regularity. But people failed it. It was a test that was administered to people who had neither a GED.
One person who apparently failed it is Ms. Beosic.
Let me move on. If the court finds that there was insufficient evidence on the four substantive counts relating to this ATB testing, the conspiracy...
Save the defendants $400.
The conspiracy conviction would... still be valid, It would make no difference in the sentencing. It would simply result in a new judgment that didn't include the substantive counts and would save them the special assessment. If the court has any questions about the other sufficiency arguments that the defendants raise, I'd be happy to deal with them. Otherwise, I'll go on to the loss calculation issue. As a result of the defendant's fraudulent conduct, particularly the fraudulent conduct with regard to the MCI Chicago loans, the government was out of pocket more than $2.8 million. Our argument in the district court always was that no offset to that amount was appropriate, but that was just an out-of-pocket loss to the government. And
by the way, is 95% an unusual default rate? What's the government's default experience in this program as a whole?
I don't know the answer to that question, but it has got to be an unusual default rate. I can't imagine.
I can imagine the government wasting billions upon billions of dollars. So.
No, I think the part of the reason the default rate was so high in this case is that the school went out of business. When the students don't even get to graduate and get their diplomas, then of course they're going to. It's much more likely that they're going to default on their loans. It's not part of the record below what the average default rate is, but 95%, I'm confident, is higher than average.
Does DOE publish? I mean, must have reports about this program or oversight hearings or some such thing.
I'm sure it does. And if you'd like me to obtain that information, I'd be happy to provide it to the court.
We can probably track it down on the Department of Education's website.
Well, I know that the rate at which students dropped out of the school, which is 68%, was unusually high because the Indiana Guarantee Agency had a cutoff of 33%. They wouldn't guarantee your loans if more than 33% of your students dropped out. And here we had a 68% dropout rate. So I know that their dropout rate was at least double.
The dropout rate only in the terminal period, or was this the dropout rate at an earlier period?
No, the dropout rate before the school closed down.
Yes, but how long before the school closed down?
Was the Indiana agency looking at the aggregate experience of the school? Or
for
the
2 years,
before,
yes.
A 2 year?
It was a 2 year dropout rate.
But in the terminal years, or was it the long-term rate? Because if your school closes, effectively, everybody is deemed to have dropped out.
No. These are the people who dropped out before the school closed.
So it's looking at 1992 through when?
I think through March or April of 1993 when the school closed.
They only had that school for a year.
Year and a few months.
Isn't the long term, actually, in this school. But they're actually looking at while the school is still a going concern somehow.
That's right.
Yeah.
The issue was raised earlier, the question of whether or not the loans would have been given had the Indiana Guarantee Agency been informed that the loans were being made for the Chicago school. The letter that the Indiana agency sent ultimately denying the MCI the ability to participate in this program is in our supplemental appendix at 140, and it talks in there about the fact that the school has had losses for two fiscal years and that the withdrawal rate has exceeded 33% threshold for the past 2 years. So that certainly suggests, and I think the district court found this, that if they had told them about the Chicago school, there would have been a review of the entire school and they would have discovered these facts, losses for the last two fiscal years and a withdrawal rate that exceeded 33% for the last 2 years, and that not only would the loans not have been made to the Illinois school, there would have been no loans made to the Indiana school either. In addition, the district court found as a separate matter that many of the students who obtained loans were ineligible. I mentioned earlier that the financial aid office was telling employees to lead students to make statements that were false in order to obtain financial aid. The district court found that as a result, many of the students who obtained these loans were not eligible for loans at all and had only obtained loans as a result of that particular fraudulent practice. Therefore, our position is and was below that the government sustained at least $2.8 million in losses, that no offset of those losses was appropriate. and therefore that the defendants received sentences that were lower than the sentences that they should have received.
Should we be bothered at all by the fact that the district court used completely different methodologies in each of these people's cases?
No, I don't think so, because in both cases, he did use different methodologies, and in both cases he subtracted from our loss a greater amount of, applied a greater offset than should have been applied. The reason that the district court used two different methodologies is because at the first sentencing, the government proposed that as an alternative measure that a certain amount of money be subtracted from its gross loss to get to net loss, and the defendant didn't object to that at all. And subsequently, at the next sentencing, the defendant objected, and then the whole proceeding, the whole issue was opened up again. Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Anything further, Mr. Morris?
I just would briefly like to return back to your example with Donald Trump, Judge Easterbrook, and to another difference from the other differences that I discussed earlier between our situation here and your hypothetical, is that Donald Trump provided no service to get his bread and milk. Here, the defendants, it's without question that the defendants provided the services in exchange. They ran a school that, by all accounts, was an operating entity with students.
Yeah, the services were provided to the students. If this were a suit by the students for fraud on them, that would certainly be highly relevant.
You're correct, Your Honor. The services were provided to the students, but they were also provided for the government. The government and the school entered into a participation agreement where
provided for the government provided that all eligibility criteria had been satisfied.
Well, you're right, Judge. It provided all eligibility had been satisfied, and the government's position is that it had not. But this is the same as the Schneider case, in that you're saying, had the government known, it wouldn't have done it. It wouldn't have done business with Schneider either. But that doesn't mean that the value that the defendants provided is not taken into account in calculating the net loss to the government. I see my time is up.
Thank you very much, Mr. Moss. The case will be taken under advisement.